People of Earth, and presumably nowhere else, although if you are somewhere besides Earth, we welcome you, as long as you understand what I'm saying. Perhaps you speak... Never mind, I'm not going to get into all that. I'm just going to let you guys know that you're welcome, people of Earth, and beyond. I am Jim Hodgson. I am the host of your podcast. This is episode 10 with Katie Hogan. This is a really great episode, guys. I know I say that a lot, but that's because they all are. Hey, if you want to support this podcast, love it if you would. Check out my books, jimhodgson.com. You can also go to the easy-to-remember URL, readmyfuckingbooks.com. My latest work is called Santa vs. Krampus. It is a rollicking thrill joyride. I don't have all of those words that they use on the back of books at hand, but you know what I'm saying. It's a great book. Would love it if you checked it out. Readmyfuckingbooks.com. I'm all over Amazon, Kindles. You know the drill. So, hey, check out this episode with Katie Hogan. Hope you enjoy it. Katie Hogan, I'm just going to say your name repeatedly, I guess.
I love the sound of my name.
She is a financial literacy educator, satirist, and sketch comedy writer. She's also the author of the Funny Financial Planner blog, part of the AOL Finance Collective. She regularly contributes to The Scold and any conversation concerning The Bachelor, which we'll get into that in a minute because that's a phenomenon I do not understand. When she's not speaking or writing about personal finance, you can find her performing with Sketchworks Comedy in Atlanta. Although this bio leaves out that you are basically the Michael Jordan of Sketchworks.
Wow. Thank you.
By which I mean like almost all of the sketches, certainly the good ones, are by you.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. That's very kind. I don't know. I mean, there's other good writers and I'm just trying to, keep up, you know, trying to do my best.
Well, it's kind of you to, sort of give a hat tip toward modesty, but the fact is you're murdering everybody in terms of sketch funniness.
Oh, thank you.
Which we celebrate, and that's how I know you, is from from Sketchworks sketch writing.
Yes.
We are co-writers. I haven't submitted anything lately because I've been busy doing other things, but they're a sketch group here in Atlanta, Georgia, perform regularly, lots of really funny stuff, and of late, all the funny stuff has been from you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I love it. It's a great time. And I got to say that your edits and contributions to my sketches or, you know, even if it's, a note like this is really funny that I enjoy and I take into consideration whatever you have to say. So I appreciate your feedback.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. That's kind of part of the job, part of the deal. We try to help each other out as writers. But because I've read that bio off of McSweeney's, it leaves out that you've written for McSweeney's.
I have written for McSweeney's, yes. And I've actually been rejected from McSweeney's more than I've been accepted, but that's the life of a writer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did have one hit piece on McSweeney's this year, so that I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, it went pretty well, and that's been recently. The title is I Googled Intersectionality, So Now I'm Totally Woke.
Yeah, I would say 90% of the feedback that and comments online were positive. And I made the mistake of reading the comments online. I normally try not to read anything about myself or my work. And I was just, I don't know, for whatever reason, I must have been bored that day. I read the comments section. And some people accused me of being like this malicious monster who was like hating on white women. And I was like, I am a white woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I think you're missing the point here.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. Well, I think it's, if I were to guess, my guess about the popularity of that piece would be that it's so true that there are some people who seem to forget, they sort of forget that facet of themselves. Like you can't just Well, I don't know. Maybe it's not true to say that you can't, but maybe it's not wise to leap day to day from term to term.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I don't know.
Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts and my family lives in upstate New York, and it's just kind of this trope of women, who feel like they know oppression and know, adversity but their version of oppression, like I wrote in the piece, is, getting catcalled on their way to Dunkin' Donuts in the morning and, and how they feel like they're doing their part, but, and trying to take probably more credit than they should. And I was even picking on myself in that regard.
That's the best, in my opinion, that's the best humor, is when you're being, when there's a kernel of honesty about what you're pointing to.
Oh, absolutely. And I had like aunts and cousins who thought, oh, did you write that about me? And I was like, no, it's not about a specific woman. It's more or less about me and kind of just, yeah, this, I don't know, this specific type of white woman that's middle class.
Right. But
it wasn't,
you know,
supposed to be mean.
No. But you know, it's tough because on the one hand, you need people to be part of whatever you're trying to do if you're trying to cause change.
Right.
But because you need people, some of the people that you get are going to be a little bit misguided.
Yes.
So it's like, is it better to have folks who are misguided or no, or not have those folks? You know, I think.
Right. Right.
I don't know the answer. I don't know either.
I just know that it's fun to poke fun at.
Well, we could certainly agree about that. Absolutely. So speaking of poking fun, let's talk about how did you get into writing funny? I think you and I have talked about this just, as friends, but for the purposes of the podcast, let's get into your history of being a funny person. I hate to see somebody else have to go through being a funny person because I suffer it myself, but... or at least I try to. But so how did that come to you?
I was a journalism major in college, and I originally wanted to be a sports writer. And so I've always loved to write. I've always been, a kind of like somebody who keeps journals. And I was writing for my hometown newspaper when I was a teenager. And it's just, writing is in my blood. I've always loved to do it. But I've also
always... I think
you
can maybe get a dialysis for that.
Yeah, it has tainted my blood. I've just always loved comedy as well, and especially sketch comedy. Grew up, I remember my grandpa used to record Saturday Night Live on his VHS and then watch it with us, on the weekends and stuff. And so I've always loved satire and comedy, and but didn't think I was good enough for a long time to do it. Didn't think I was funny enough. And then you reach a certain point in your life, a certain age, and you're just like, I don't really. Can I swear on this podcast?
Absolutely. Look, oh, okay. Yeah, I always say you don't have to dip to my level, but you certainly can.
I just stopped giving a shit what other people said, or if they made fun of me for wanting to take an improv class or a sketch class, whatever. And so I said, I'm just going to do it because I really love this. And when I moved down to Georgia, I just randomly found Sketchworks online, and I started taking classes with them. And I really loved it. I loved all the people. And I said, I have an interest in writing sketches, and they were like, oh yeah, that's what everybody says. And and so I said, well, I'll submit some stuff and see if you like it. And they did, they loved it. So, I've been writing with them ever since, almost about a year and a half now. And I've really, grown to love writing comedy and writing satire and sketches. So, and I've even done a little bit of stand up, which is not my thing, but
you don't think I'm interested to hear you talk about that too. having myself spent a lot of time doing both, tell me what you find the differences to be.
Well, you know, it's having, instead of having readers or on a, you know, when I submit something to a satirical website, you know, I don't have to look into the faces of my readers. But, you know, you get up on that stage and it's kind of the human nature, because you know, your jokes are funny. I know my jokes are funny, but it's about delivery. So yeah. I think my delivery is a lot better with the written word, and maybe it's because I haven't done stand up a lot. It's fine, you know, it really is an art form to be able to find the delivery that's right for you, to get your joke across in a way that's going to keep it funny. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm just more confident and more comfortable with just being a writer. But at the same time, I do a lot of public speaking and stuff with like my financial planning stuff and financial literacy. So I do want to become a more confident speaker. And I think, you know, doing stand up is a good way to kind of get over those fears.
Yeah. You know, I'm like you in that I love the art form. The thing about comedy is if you can, sometimes it's almost like when you say a joke, it's like a question. And
yeah,
the way that you act after you say it determines whether people will laugh or not. So if it looks like you're nervous, then people won't laugh because they can't trust you to entertain right. them in a way. So I've been able to take stuff that was only like medium funny and turn it into a little bit more funny just by staring at the crowd and not caring.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. It's just getting over that that fear of failure, that and kind of just trusting yourself and trusting the audience that, you know, even if this blows up in your face, like you're going to live and survive through it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very sad to tell you, very very comfortable with failure. But yeah, I love it. I'm so glad I get to, you know, I got a monthly show still going, so I get to kind of stay in touch. And it's a little bit weird doing like a monologue style thing because I write a new 5 minutes or so every month. I still love, the thing I love about stand-up comedy, and this is true of improv too, the nice thing about it is if you have gone in front of people that you don't know and said something and you've heard the laugh, no one can take that away from you because
right.
the first thing anybody wants to say to us as comedy writers is, well, you're not funny and this isn't funny and that's not funny. And that, because everybody thinks they know how to be funny because mm-hmm. they've made their family laugh, but it is a 180,000,000% different thing to do improv or sketch or stand up and hear those live laughs, you know, and right. I think those are sort of the only kind of armor you can get as a humor writer, just because whenever somebody says to me, you know, like I'll see book reviews and it's like, well, this isn't funny or I didn't like this or whatever. It's like, look, I've heard the laughs, like mm-hmm. I've heard them. I know that I can do it. So you can't take that away from me. That's the one thing that I do love about it. But you know, I think certainly you, in terms of writing sketch, can be heartened by the fact that now, whenever Sketchworks goes to plan a new show, they're like, okay, we're gonna do 8 Hogan sketches, and if any of you other schmucks happen to write something halfway decent, maybe we'll get to it.
Yeah, it's fun. I love it. I really do love it. And, you know, it's something that I wish that with hindsight's 2020, and I wish that I just had done this since college and had pursued it, you know, even harder when I was younger, but I'm glad I'm doing it now. And it's so much fun too. It's just so fun to, you know, it's kind of my way to, I don't know if like rebel or if that's the right word, but it is my way of kind of being a little bit rebellious, I think, and being able to write what I actually want to say a lot of times, and mm-hmm. and it's a good outlet for me because I'm like super non-confrontational, But a lot of times my sketches and my satire will kind of come off as almost confrontational. And so it's like a bolder, better version of myself.
Right. Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah. That's as you say, it's one of the most beautiful things about it. So let's talk about finance a little bit.
Sure.
You are sort of reaching for the dream, as I think of it, which is being able to have something that really makes money, like makes good, like, and when I say good money, I mean like normal people money, like just a just a regular grown-up human being job. You know, as a humor writer, this is something that's like reaching for the stars, you know. But so you're trying to help people become financially literate,
right?
But also you're using your comedy chops to sort of help people think about things.
Right. Yeah. So this, you know, when I first, I guess I'm a financial planner by trade, and that basically came about because, long story short, I graduated college and I had like six figures worth of student loan debt, and I was like a journalism major. So, you know, journalists.
Right.
It's like, you know, 25 grand a year at a local newspaper, and you don't even know if you'll have your job next year.
Or next week.
Yeah, or next week. And so I said, oh my God, I have to figure out how to get a hold of my own finances. So I started just reading every personal finance book I could get my hand on. I used to go to the library every day at lunch. And I read a ton of personal finance books and kind of became obsessed with it. And then I thought to myself, okay, wait a minute. So if I'm a fairly intelligent person, and I managed to get all the way through grad school without knowing anything about mm-hmm. personal finance, I go, I can't be the only one who's in this position. And so it turns out there are millions of people just like me who don't know anything about money management or, you know, how to invest, how to save, how to pay down debt, anything. So, it inspired me, and I eventually changed careers, became a financial advisor, and then a few years in, launched my own firm because I didn't want to. I don't know. I worked for a big firm, and they just wanted me to go after like 80-year-olds with $3 million, and I'm like, first of all, they don't want to listen to me because I'm young, mm-hmm. and second of all, like it wasn't what I really wanted to do, which was help and teach people who were my age and younger, and kind of warn them about the dangers of credit cards and student loans and things like that. But also to kind of arm them with the knowledge that they will need throughout their entire lives. So, mm-hmm. I started blogging, and you know, my business was honestly like not doing well at all. And finally, I can't remember who it was. Somebody said, "Well, why don't you just try to make it funny?" And I was like, oh, I don't know how to do that. And then I started thinking, okay, so if you see people like, where do young people get their news? And it's, you know, John Oliver and Samantha Bee and The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is taking really complex, tedious, boring news topics and making them, you know, digestible and hilarious. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I can do that with topics about money and career. And so I started doing that, especially with the Scold. I just was basically like, hey, can I like write my own column, and it turned into this experiment to see if, you know, this was going to work. And within a couple of articles, it was working. So people started responding to it. And I think that financial illiteracy, part of the problem with it is it's just so boring and awful, and nobody wants to learn about it because it's just like, I mean, god awful boring. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm one of the first people to put a humorous spin on it to make it relatable and informative at the same time. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do. But yeah, so that's, I don't even remember. I've been ranting, so I don't even remember what the question was.
Well, I just wanted to hear you answered it exactly. I just wanted to hear you talk a little bit about putting finance and being funny together. You touched on just now, you touched on the Scold. Do you want to talk about the Scold a little bit? Just, I mean,
me running into them was a total chance opportunity it was basically all by chance. They started following me on, I think it was like Instagram or Twitter or something like that. And I was like, oh, what is this? And I saw it was like this kind of this feminist website that was fairly new, and they were looking for contributors. And I had this idea about writing a funny financial column kind of geared towards helping young women. And so I emailed them and I was like, hey, could I write stuff for you? And they said, well, yeah, give it a try. And it worked, and they liked what I was doing, and I liked that they were reaching out to kind of the target demographic that I was also trying to reach. And I've been with them since I think October of last year, and it's been going pretty well, and they've grown a lot, and I love it. It's really helped me build my business, and I hope that I'm helping them build theirs. So it's a fun site. The editors are great, and it was just luck. It was honestly they followed me and I reached out, and it was very lucky.
Well, I mean, I'm looking over a list of your articles here. I mean, and they're, it's stuff that you need to know, but, it sure helps that what I like about your way of delivering is that you're making fun of yourself and being vulnerable in a way, because you're poking fun at yourself. For example, I don't know, talking about your softball uniform or, I mean, yeah, I think it's a great message. I mean, people can identify with you. Like it wasn't like you were born into finance.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And I think when people think of financial planners and financial advisors or anyone who works in finance, they think of like a 55-year-old white guy with a balding, one of those cul-de-sacs on their head, like the hair on the bottom, no hair on the top.
Yeah.
It's a cul-de-sac. That's what they think of. So I'm trying to put a new face on, personal finance and investing and things like that, and make it more, more relatable, less intimidating. I don't know. That's what I'm going for. People are probably like, this girl's nuts.
No, I don't think so. I'm the son of an accountant, so I have enough financial sense to know how terrible my habits are. But at the same time, I've had some other, I've had some moments, and I try to at least not be an embarrassment to my father, the CPA.
Isn't that all of our goals?
Yeah, it really is. So we talked about your sketch writing first, because that's why I wanted to have you as a guest, because I think you're so funny, and you're good at getting through that kind of thing. So in a minute we'll get to getting through a novel idea, but you've thought about doing some novel work, haven't you?
Yeah. I have a book coming out. It's not a novel. It's a collection of essays that I've written about money, career, and relationships. And it does kind of take on the voice of the, what I do on the Scold. Mm-hmm. It's called The Millennial's Guide to Getting Your Shit Together, which I thought about a title for a very long time, and this has been a really long process for me. And I was like, everything I'm writing, it's just about getting your shit together. Like, that's what we're all trying to do in our 20s and 30s is just get your shit together. So I was like, I think, my grandmother's she's probably going to be pretty disappointed in the title, but I think it's catchy. And
I do too. I'm with you.
I hope it, I hope it does all right. And, maybe just my family and closest friends will buy it. But, I think it's, it's truly, that's what the essays are about. It's about getting your shit together.
I think that it's, I don't know, man. I'm as much as it seems like it's not a great idea to put shit in the title, look how well, Shit My Dad Says. Go the fuck to sleep.
My sister just read a book called You Are a Badass. And yeah.
And then there's the subtle art of not giving a fuck. So it's a you know, you're kind of, I don't know, I think you're right to have that messaging, because, you know, I think your target market is not likely to be fazed by it at all.
Right.
I mean, you know, here at our house, we have what we call shit friendly. So if you're if you need to say a bad word, it's okay to say shit. But we draw the line at the other bad words. But we're shit friendly. So, you know.
That's hilarious.
I think it's good to, one of the beautiful things about profanity is that it can let people know who your intended audience is. So,
right, right.
I think you're on point there.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I like to, I mean, I don't like to swear a lot, but I think it's, I don't know. I read something about like people who swear are more intelligent. So I just keep telling my parents that. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hopefully one day they'll be on board with it.
Well, you know, if you just keep repeating things, they end up being true.
That's right. That's right.
That's what habits is all about. All right. Katie Hogan, are
yes.
you ready to enter the Thunderdome?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm surprised that you said yes. So now I have to actually construct a Thunderdome. So
yeah.
I'll get the wife on the welder and we'll have it done in a couple weeks. All right. So you might or might not be familiar with the format of the podcast, but what we do here is we take a writing prompt from the previous week's guest, and the next guest attempts to compose a workable novel outline from that prompt.
Nice.
And yours will come from John Hartness, who mm-hmm. is a very prolific novelist and publisher. Really hilarious dude, like gregarious, funny guy to be around. And he asked before, just at the end of my recording with him, who would be getting his recommendation. And I had already scheduled this with you, so he knew that this would be going to you. So, are you ready?
Uh-oh.
You're going to knock it out of the park. It's not going to be a problem.
All right, let's do this.
Okay, here we go. A 20th century woman travels through time and ends up on Blackbeard's pirate ship. She has a Swiss Army knife and a flare gun.
Okay, wow. Yeah, I immediately just see Johnny Depp.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's certainly positioned himself that way, right?
Yeah, so okay, so a 20th century woman travels through time. She lands on, did you say Blackbeard's ship?
Blackbeard's pirate ship, yes.
Pirate ship. And she has a Swiss Army knife. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what a flare gun.
And a flare gun?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So what I like to do is right out of the gate when I'm thinking about a novel idea, I like to think about what is our life as normal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when she is transported through time, that would be our inciting incident. So act one would happen before that, because we want to see her in her everyday life.
Right.
Before she gets transported back to Blackbeard. What are you thinking in terms of causes for being transported through time?
So the first place my mind went was early 20th century.
Oh, I like that.
Like she is some kind of like 19, it's like 1920 or something like that. And she is like a suffragette or something like that. And God, but why would she travel through time? There's like some hole in the space-time continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need some reason that she... I don't know, maybe she's friends with Nikola Tesla.
Yes. Yes.
And she visits his laboratory, and he turns on the Tesla coil, but there's something about...
Is she like his, like, she... Well, I... The feminist side of me is like, oh, she was like one of the secret, you know, behind every great man is a great woman. And she was one of the great women behind Tesla, helping him create whatever, and she like gets accidentally shocked or something, and it sends her through time.
That, yeah, yeah, so. I like that. What I was thinking is like she, for whatever reason, she's there. You know, she's, I don't know, checking gauges or setting things up, making sure things work right. But she's on her way to a meeting of the suffragettes.
Okay.
And for that reason, she's wearing a she's wearing a full skirt. You know, they would wear like the white.
And she I'm has thinking, like a votes for women sash on.
Yeah, but there's something about her clothes. Maybe it's like, I guess that's probably a little bit too modern for a hoop skirt. But I was thinking like, there are like metal pieces in the hoop skirt, and she and part of her job is to tell people, okay, look, if you're gonna work in the lab, you're gonna have to wear like pants and a shirt. Because you can't have loose clothing in the lab because it's going to get caught in some piece of machinery and you're going to get injured. And not to mention The machinery is going to get broken and then I'm going to have to fix it and I don't want to, you know. So, but she's short on time. So she comes to the lab to handle some issue on the way to go to her suffragette meeting. And because mm-hmm. she's dressed differently to go there, then she gets, I don't know,
yeah, like the, yeah, so she, this is a tough one. So somehow she gets like this I don't know anything about science, but I.
It doesn't matter.
I'm imagining she somehow.
We're fiction writers, like, so we don't, we do not have to care about that stuff.
What if her like dress got like caught on one of like Tesla's inventions? And that, you know, and she's like, you know, and then the two metal pieces, whatever the metal part of her dress touches the metal part of the invention. Mm-hmm. And it's like a Back to the Future moment where, you know, the space time continuum opens up.
1.21 gigawatts.
Yeah, exactly.
88 miles an hour, et cetera. Okay, I like it.
Yeah, yeah. And so then she, yeah, so she doesn't make it to the suffragette meeting. And they're like, where is this bitch?
Okay, but she's got, I don't know why, maybe she's got a flare gun because it's like, it's part of their, it's part of the procedure at the lab where if there's any kind of problem, you shoot this flare gun in the air and everybody knows. Yeah. Everybody knows if she shoots a flare gun, then it's like everything stops.
Right. And she probably had the Swiss Army knife because she was like trying, she grabbed it. She was trying to like get her caught dress unhooked from the, whatever Tesla's invention was that, you know, eventually sent her through time.
Right.
She was like trying to get free of that. And so that's, yeah, I guess that's why she would be armed with a Swiss Army knife and a flare gun.
Yeah. Okay, so that gets us, now we are done with Act 1. We are into Act 2. We've seen our inciting incident go by. So let's start thinking about some Act 2 stuff. Like what kind of difficulties is she going to face on the ship with Blackbeard?
Yeah, so this is going to be even tougher than dealing with the dude she normally deals with. Let me think here. So she lands on Blackbeard's ship and like, I'm assuming they haven't like seen a woman in a very long time. What time period is Blackbeard normally set in?
One moment. Let's see. Years active, 1716 through 1718.
Okay, so she's like going back a couple hundred years.
Yes.
Okay.
I just quickly Googled that. I didn't have it off the top of my head.
if you had said, like, oh, I just know this, then I would have believed you.
Right. Well, look. I don't think you can have a good relationship with your writing colleagues by lying to them.
Well, let me see. It was 1717.
Yes.
Okay, so this is all right.
But that's almost around 200 years. It's like
exactly.
I mean, if we made her 1917, then she would have gone back exactly 200 years.
Okay, that would make sense, sort of. That makes sense in this fictional setting, yes.
Right.
It's so weird that she would end up on, like, she has to be sent there for a purpose.
Right. Maybe, I'm just, sorry, I think you were about to speak, but maybe the purpose is that, much as it might not seem, like, what we learned through the course of the book is that Blackbeard and his crew are, in history, were actually the most ready to be woke. It just so happened that they were, for whatever reason, on the outside of the law. And during the book, she ends up leading 200 years or 250 years earlier than the suffragette movement. She ends up leading a successful suffragette movement with the help of the pirates.
Yes. That is genius.
Well, it is but a suggestion.
Yeah. So, she kind of changes the course of history. It's like something where Blackbeard ends up doing something or not doing something that ends up leading to the suffragette movement, but nobody knows that it was because this one particular woman traveled back in time and influenced him in a way, something like that.
So if that's what we're going to go with, then we'll need some beats in Act Two where the people, the pirates on the ship are not on board. And we'll need I'm imagining in my mind like a 12 Angry Men where over the course of the, like when she lands there in the beginning, it's clear that there's no way any of these pirates are ever going to be on board with equality, feminism of any type. But then slowly but surely, she's, through her actions, is converting the crew.
Yeah, it's like a Sound of Music type of thing where she is like,
yeah.
slowly influencing the captain and the crew and, you know, not to be Nazis or pirates or whatever.
Yeah, or pirate Nazis for that matter.
Pirate Nazis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are some scenes we could sort of, what are some scenes that we could put her in where, you know, who do you think on would be a good member, like the first member of the ship to come around to her way of thinking?
I think it would be like the lowliest guy, like the low man on the totem pole, the guy that's like cleaning the poop deck or whatever it's called.
Yeah. I like that.
She's like sitting there and they're like, we have no idea how you got onto this ship. And she's like, I accidentally traveled through time. I'm from 1917, clearly.
Right. And don't you see the flare gun? Come on.
I have a flare gun and a Swiss Army knife. And so she like strikes up a friendship with, because they don't know what to do with her. They, you know, she's like almost an alien figure to them. So they don't kill her. They don't throw her overboard, but they kind of keep her, just let her stay on the ship. Mm-hmm. And maybe she befriends this lowly pirate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe he sees her as like a mother figure or something. And
I like that.
And she kind of teaches him, and he's like, well, what does votes for women on your sash mean? And she starts teaching him about feminism.
Right. I like it.
And he's like, well, that doesn't make sense because, like, you know, women are clearly inferior.
Right. But I'm thinking, but, like, maybe we have a beat where, like, she knows how to cure scurvy. Like,
yeah, I was just thinking about that. Maybe she's, like, at dinner with all of them or something. And like she's having dinner with all the pirates on the ship and they're like below deck or whatever. And I don't know, something happens where she teaches them something valuable. She knows what ailments would they have had that would have been cured by like 1917, or like what wisdom could she impart on them?
I think I'm, you know, like I said, I think scurvy, just because scurvy. It's easy because it's, if you eat enough, it looks like commonly associated with sailors in the 16th to 18th century. So yeah, this is that time, but
right.
It's the cause is just a lack of vitamin C.
Right. It's just not eating vegetables.
Yeah. Not eating vegetables. So that's why they call English people limeys, because they would eat limes on their ships. And they did that because they didn't want scurvy. So,
right.
Like all these men are suffering from scurvy, and they're like, maybe they're in port and they're running out of room in the ship. And they're like, well, it's no problem. We'll just get rid of these stupid limes. And she's like, don't do that, you idiots.
Yeah. She's like, well, why don't you just, you know, eat some fruits and vegetables? And they're like, wait, what?
Some what and whatables?
Yeah. Like they only eat like bread and meat. So, yeah, maybe she teaches them, you know, she's just like kind of like deadpans, like, why don't you just eat those limes? And she cures their scurvy and she's a hero.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
But maybe Blackbeard's still kind of like skeptical. Maybe that she thinks she's like a witch or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's got to be last.
Yeah, he's got to be last.
Because he's got the name and it's his ship. And I'm thinking that we're going to have in the book, we're going to have at least one naval battle.
Okay, yeah.
So my thought is, like, all this, Blackbeard is distrustful, blah, 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 whatever reason. So we're going through all these beats in Act Two.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's converting the crew. They're coming over to her side. And Blackbeard is getting more and more upset by this, not only because he doesn't agree, but also because he sees his control on the ship slipping away.
Right.
And then they're attacked. And the ship, so they're having this, she and Blackbeard are having this fight, and he's yelling because he's feeling, you know, marginalized or whatever.
Yeah.
He's just basically being an insecure dick about things. Sorry to your memory, Blackbeard, to call you an insecure dick. But anyway, so there's a fight and he is lost, and she and the crew go after Blackbeard against impossible odds, kind of thing. Like there's this giant armada that they're going to face. And they're able to, they have a big fight. They capture Blackbeard, and mm-hmm. it's all because of her technical knowledge, that she's able to use whatever parts are at hand on the ship to overcome this great foe, get Blackbeard back. He understands that she's brilliant. They end up on a great big, I don't know, you know, ship together.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you thinking in terms of love story? Are you thinking love story or no?
So that would be hilarious if the suffragette fell in love with Blackbeard.
Maybe that's book two.
It's the sequel. Yeah. So let me think here. Maybe she finds herself falling in love with Blackbeard, but like remembers that, you know, she's from 200 years in the future. So like, you know, they can't be together.
Right.
Because she eventually, I don't know, does she get back to 1917? Like, how does that happen? Or does she stay forever with Blackbeard?
It's a good question. What I would like the happy ever ending to be is that they begin an alternate timeline when the entire world becomes more aware of equality equal rights for everybody because she's converted Blackbeard. And if that's the case, then we'll have to get to the point where he's converted much earlier in the book. Like that'll have to happen mid act two. And then from there, you know, they, I don't know, like the end to me, in my mind, the end is they have this armada of boats that are all, you know, they're all about equality and, you know, they have,
They sail the world teaching equality.
Yeah, they have you know, captains of every size, shape, color, and creed, and, you know, it's just...
That's awesome. I really like that. And I think the point of where Blackbeard becomes like this converted feminist, and he believes in her, is when at the point where she rescues him.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that epic battle, when finally he sees that she has taken control of the ship and she has led the pirates to this rescue,
mm-hmm.
he has this epiphany and enlightenment, and he's like, oh my God,
I have been such an asshole.
I am such a fucking dick. And yeah. And so it's in that moment where it's not even maybe, he doesn't even like love her, but he respects her. And, I am getting into this deep feminism thing.
Well, hey, look, that's what we're all about. Let's do it.
I mean, yeah, I know like Brian Troxell, the producer at Sketchworks, is going to listen to this and he'll be like, again, Hogan, again.
Well, as soon as it stops being a problem, it'll stop being interesting to talk about.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I'm saying. Come on now.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's converted at the point of rescue, and then they then sail off and have this armada of equality ships.
It's like a gigantic pride parade on the ocean at all times.
It is Pride Month, so I mean this makes total sense. And it was the very first Pride parade. It was Blackbeard leading a Pride parade.
I mean,
obviously.
He's dyed his beard rainbow colors.
It was like...
They're all jamming out to It's Raining Men. I love it.
It's so good. Yeah. And so, I'm starting to think that this novel probably has some really great comedic points in it.
Oh, yeah. This is how it always goes. It's like, in the beginning, it seems like such a big job to make a novel idea out of, you know, whatever the prompt is. But as soon as you kind of figure out what act one, like what the turn from act one to act two is going to be, and then you start having some thoughts about what your big showdown at the end of the book is going to be, your end of act two into act three, then once you have those two things, then filling in act two is really, really fun, because you get to come up with all these, you know, you get to come up with all these beats like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if blah, 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 you know?
Right.
So, and along that, and having that thought, I got an idea for a B plot for you.
Okay, go ahead.
So there's their main antagonist is the English armada, maybe Spanish armada, but the Spanish captain will look at our main character and be like, okay, she's really, really hot, and I want to get with her. And because... And he's like, he'll represent like, you know, he'll be very sharply dressed, very well spoken, very highly educated, very well groomed, like a really good looking guy. But there will be no, we'll understand through the movie that there's no possibility that he's ever gonna be woke, you know, like.
Right, right. So he's like Mel Gibson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Like a Spanish version.
Yeah, he's. He goes on racist rants to his own wife. It's just no good. So, but the reason I want that in there is it's like we begin to see that Blackbeard has it. If even though he's not where he needs to be at the beginning of the movie, he has the capacity to get there.
Right.
And he represents the change that we want to make.
Mm-hmm.
But then this, and so maybe Blackbeard's jealous of this English armada guy because he's got an armada and Blackbeard just has the one ship and a really awesome beard. But anyway, that's one.
Yeah, too. I like that. And the Spanish armada guy just kind of, he's arrogant and just assumes that the suffragette I don't think we've given her a name, but,
no, we should though.
That she's just going to fall in love with him and be, you know, one of his mistresses, and she's like, yeah, you are hot, but you know, I need more than good looks.
Yeah. I need you to be woke, buddy. And you are no kind of woke. ¿Cómo se dice woke in español, por favor?
She's like, I need to know that you're going to do 50% of the household chores and child raising.
Yeah. Minimum, buddy.
Minimum.
Yeah, I think we're kind of there. Okay, so anything else? What do you think we're missing?
I mean, I think, yeah, so it goes from she accidentally travels through time. She's one of Tesla's assistants. She's on her way to a suffragette meeting. She gets caught on this invention, and it transports her back 200 years. She lands on Blackbeard's ship. She starts befriending the crew. Blackbeard's getting more and more pissed off because he doesn't know if she's like this kind of like witchcraft lady or, you know, if she's trying to overthrow him by befriending all the guys. Mm-hmm. And then, but, you know, slowly but surely they're learning all these valuable lessons about equality and treating people with respect. And then they come upon this Blackbeard. He's probably like, hey, like eventually we're going to run into some trouble here. And I need these guys to not be like, you know, being all, you know, mm-hmm. emotional and wimpy. And I need them to be ready to battle. And she's like, you don't have to worry about that. And, yeah. And then they come upon the Spanish Armada and this guy wants to destroy them. Because what's the conflict between the Spanish Armada guy and Blackbeard? Are they just rivals or?
Like, no, Blackbeard is, he makes his money by
stealing.
He's a pirate. So if they find a Spanish ship somewhere, then they'll attack it and try to add that ship to their group. So,
got it.
You know, basically what's happening is, Blackbeard is, they go on raids and things like that, and they steal stuff. And the Crown have asked the Armada to go after Blackbeard because they've sent a couple of ships here and there, but because he's such a successful captain, you know, he's able to elude or whatever. So his wantedness is rising to, and he's like public enemy number one in Spain.
Got it.
And so this guy, the Spanish Armada guy, is like the cop who's been sent to deal with him.
Okay. 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 So it just shows you how much I know about history.
Well, you know.
I mean, all that I know about Blackbeard, it's like from the Pirates of the Caribbean. That's pretty much it.
That's okay.
Okay. That. Yeah. So, man, there's like this. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So. There's some themes there going on with like the Spanish Armada being the cop.
Yeah.
And Blackbeard.
You know, I feel like I could get a whole, not just a movie, but like, cause I've already got, I got idea for book two already.
this is intense. I mean, there are some really deep messages here.
Yeah.
Clearly.
But also a lot, I think there are just a ton of funny moments in there. Like, I'll give you an example. I'm thinking about like Blackbeard and the crew have to go ashore for whatever reason, and this is midway through the movie, so some of them have been converted to a more progressive mode of thought.
Yeah.
And so they land and go ashore, and Blackbeard's like, okay, listen, guys, we've always had big problems with these people. They're completely unreasonable. They're a bunch of jerks, and they're likely to attack us and blah, blah, blah. But when the converted members of the crew come into contact with these enemies, the enemies realize that the converted members are, you know, progressives now. So they have this great relationship as a result, and they don't get attacked and they don't get beheaded. And Blackbeard's like, well, what the hell, man? I was like, you know, I came here for a fight and now these guys are my friends, I guess. And I don't even know what the world means anymore.
Yeah, I mean, what do we do without violence? Like,
yeah, it's like we're going to have to consider people's feelings and relate with them on a case-by-case basis.
Man, can you imagine?
It's like the shittiest piracy ever. All right, look, I'm really excited about this idea. I'm sorry if I'm talking too much. I mean, you're the guest.
No, I love it. I love it.
So here's my idea for book two. Tesla, we're beginning book two. We see the Pride Parade. Life is normal. Is they're just enjoying equality. So they're going along. They're on the ship. Boom. Tesla appears out of nowhere.
Okay, yeah.
And he's like, I'm so sorry that this happened, but don't worry. I've created this machine that can take you back. And then the whole of book two is her deciding whether to go back in time, back to her own time, or stay with Blackbeard and continue to spread this message of equality.
Wow, yes. Such a difficult choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's terrific. That is, I mean, I like that we have Tesla involved in all this. And yeah, this is really great.
So this is, it's reminding me a little bit of Diana Gabaldon's books. She's a romance writer that my wife likes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a series, what is it called? Yeah, Outlander.
So, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so in her story, there's a lady who gets sent back to a sort of medieval Scotland, I guess.
Right.
And then somehow over the course of the, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but somehow over the course of these long books, she goes back to modern day and then back to the past and then back to modern day again. She's just flipping back and forth all over time. But, you know, it's got some, I think our book is going to be more fun to read though and sillier.
Yeah. It's, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. It's what will she choose? Is it possible for her to spread her message in two different time periods? And how does that, you know, there's a million ways you could go with this.
Oh yeah. That's a great conflict. Cause yeah. Is what if Tesla's like, but we need you here. And she's like, but if I stay here, I'm 200 years earlier. And
yeah. Then,
you know,
and I've got this armada.
Right. Right. And I got the Swiss Army knife and this
I have a flare gun
that I never used. Wow. We really blew it on that.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe part of the, she could have used the flare gun in the battled or the rescue or something, or like the Swiss Army knife she mm-hmm. takes out and like she knives through the ropes that have Blackbeard tied up or something.
Yes. And, yes.
You know.
It'd be like a MacGyver style montage.
Oh yeah, she is a definite MacGyver, yeah, for sure.
That's really awesome.
What is it? Saturday Night Live, they have MacGruber.
Yeah.
MacGruber. Where everyone just always blows up.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Yes. Yeah, that would be great if she, it's that deeper message of she freed herself from the Tesla invention with that Swiss Army knife, and now she's freeing somebody else. And it's, I don't know what the real message of that is. I just think it's funny.
Well, yeah, we don't have to. You know, when people ask us about this, when we're all on the red carpet, they'll want us to give comments about the deeper message. But I think it's wise if we just say, look, it's up to the audience. Because mm-hmm. as soon as you commit to what the message of your right. work is, then you rob whoever didn't agree that that was the message. Now you've robbed them of your work, right?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the great songwriters and the great
sketch writers.
And the legendary sketch writers. They, when they die, they take those secrets to the grave.
Yeah.
You know,
as
let
they
the
should.
Let the people know. When in all actuality, it's like, I don't know what this means.
Right. Those secretive pricks, how dare they?
We just don't, you know, we just don't let our secrets out.
All right. We have but two mountains to climb. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. First of all, we need a title for this work.
Oh, God. Let's see.
If it's making you laugh, it might be a good title. I'm just saying.
Blackbeard. Like something like Blackbeard on the Equality Seas. Or pirates.
How about The Woke Boats.
The Woke Boats. Yes.
That doesn't, is it. I don't know.
Blackbeard and the Woke Boats.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, I don't know how studios aren't going to just like throw like millions of dollars our way.
Get your inbox ready. It is coming.
This is literally like the next big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Just coming behind the success of Wonder Woman. Come on. We'll get Gal Gadot in this thing.
This is great. Last summer they had the female Ghostbusters. This summer we've got Wonder Woman, and next summer we're gonna have Blackbeard and the Woke Boats.
Oh yeah. Okay, and finally, we need you to come up with a prompt for our next guest, and I will tell you. I'm gonna go ahead and tell you, since I've already said that I would, and I know that you know this person and you know her work. Uh-oh. But I think I might stop telling people who the next guest is going to be. Just, I don't know. Maybe that's unfair to tell the previous person who the next person is going to be, since the next person has no way to, you know, reciprocate. But anyway, yours is going to be Leanna Adams.
I knew you were going to say Leanna. Oh, God. I got to give her something good. Let's see here. Well, immediately, I'm right off the bat. This morning I was watching the Comey testimony and all that. So mm-hmm. I was thinking of like a courtroom drama. So
I like it.
So maybe, yeah, maybe a. Oh, okay, all right. So maybe this is it's a mystery where this guy and this girl, the two detectives, they're partners. They are called out to this rural farm where this farmer has discovered a dead alien.
Oh.
And the dead alien is holding a dildo. and that last part is for Leanna.
I love it. I mean, she
loves blue humor. So
yeah. Well, she's hilarious. But I'm thinking like, I mean, I could write an hour of dialogue just on, is it a dildo? Is it not a dildo?
Right.
So they got to send it to the Air Force, everybody's like, that looks like a dildo.
It's a mystery.
Yeah,
it's a mystery.
We know it looks like a dildo. We know that. Okay, but we got to test it to see if it. Well, how do you want me to test it? Get your mind out of the gutter. All right. We're going to use the alien testing shit like normal.
Yeah, I mean, oh, man. Sometimes it scares me right where my mind goes.
Well, I think, you know, look, if you're going to be a humor writer, you got to.
Yeah. You got to be a little bit dark. You got to be a little bit crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Katie Hogan, thank you so much for joining us and agreeing to do this. You can find her and her financial planning business at HoganFinancialPlanning.com. We'll put links to all this in the description. If you want to laugh, you should come to a Sketchworks show. You will see Katie Hogan's work. You might even see Katie performing. And basically, if a laughing sound is coming out of your face, you're probably watching one of her sketches. What of yours can we find on YouTube? What have they filmed of yours?
Yeah, so Office Equality was the newest one that I wrote, and that is on Sketchworks website. That is also on Funny or Die. It's on YouTube, so it's called Office Equality.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show description too.
Yeah, and then I did one more for Sketchworks called The Gift Swap, which we did around Christmas and the holidays, and I wrote that one as well, and I'm actually in that one, so you
awesome.
Can see my weird mug.
Well, it's not weird. Well, like I say, thank you so much. You really knocked it out of the park, and all links to all that stuff will be in the description, so you can check her out and see her being hilarious. And thanks so much again, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much, Jim. I had a blast.